Tech Talk Show, an hour of tech news, information, and discussion. You're tuning in with me, Jeremy Eames, and our very own Steve Griffiths. We also have joining us this week John Pankhurst from Splat and Andrew Benison from Prospect Games. But first, I believe you have some news for us from the last week in the tech world, Steve.
Yeah. Hi, John. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here. It's been a week of launches, Jay, actually.
It has.
And it's been fantastic. And I know you're going to cover probably the most important launch that's taking place this week.
Don't know what that would be.
And maybe the most controversial. We'll see. But I have got some great news for gamers. And that is that the PS4 Pro, which is 4K, which is ultra-high definition, was launched. And I've been looking at some of the promo stuff coming out, and it looks absolutely fantastic. There's some of the games I've looked at, some of their actual visuals and graphics. One of them is Horizon Zero Dawn. I actually copied a link on Twitter, actually, on our show Twitter page. And the quality is going to be amazing.
Wow.
So couple that console with your 4K TV, and it's going to be as though you're there.
So you're a big gamer, Steve?
Well, no, and actually the history of game consoles, I've got a little bit of a rundown. I don't know, John, are you a gamer? Have you?
Yeah, we are. We love to play it at home.
Yeah. What's your favourite? What are you?
Well, we've been playing a recent No Man's Sky.
Okay.
That came out on PS4 earlier in the week, and the sheer expanse of the game is blowing
us away.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a little thing here. It all started with a Magnavox Odyssey in 1972. That probably was a tennis game, you know, the little ping pong thing. Obviously, Atari in 77, Nintendo Famicom in 83. And in 88, obviously, my favourite was the Sega Mega Drive. Oh, and I've spent hours and hours playing that game. In fact, I gamer's thumb, I think, through playing that.
Was that Tetris? On
nearly,
Sega?
Yeah. No, it was. I played, obviously, Sonic, which was huge back in the day, and also Desert Storm. There was a great Desert Storm game on the Sega Mega Drive. So anyway, we've got the PS4 launch. The PS4 normal, not the Pro, is still going to be available. So they're running both game consoles in tandem. I assume, too, because obviously the 4K telly thing, people actually haven't got their monitors set up. So, yeah. I think you've got a launch news
well,
as well, Joe.
I don't know if you've heard. I mean, I haven't really heard of it till this morning, but Apple have launched the new iPhone 7. And the reception hasn't been that great from what I've seen.
Yeah, it's a bit mixed, really, isn't it?
Yeah, specifically their new AirPods.
Right.
So they've ditched the headphones.
Okay.
And they've replaced them with these AirPods. Which actually retail for £160.
160 quid. John, would you pay that for a set of headphones for your phone?
Tricky one. I think they should rebrand them Lost Pods. So you probably lose them pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, they've got no... If they fall out of your ear, that's it. They're gone. Is that right? I couldn't see that they're connected
just,
or anything.
That's it.
So, and also, Paul... from Channel Radio was talking about earlier, would you pay nearly £1,000 for a 7XL?
No. Well, no. Well, I couldn't possibly even think about affording that. It seems extreme.
I mean, I use Apple. Yeah, everybody's got probably iPhones, you know, knocking around. But I'm not sure £1,000 is going to be justified. Mm. I don't know. John, would you?
I do believe that the telephoto... lens combined with the wide angle gives you that lovely depth of field in portrait. I think that was lacking.
Yeah, so
£1,000.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
So other new features they've got as well are a home button that can now detect how firmly it's being pressed and provide a vibration-based feedback, but it no longer moves into the phones, which is quite an interesting one. The handsets can be submerged in waters up to a depth of a meter, which is about 3.2 feet. And the larger iPhone 7 Plus model has a two-lens camera on its rear, allowing you a choice of focal lengths. So that's quite interesting, although I feel like there was kind of a huge build-up to this phone. And to be honest, to me, it looks the same, but just a few kind of more defined features.
Yeah.
Definitely not worth a grand.
No, and it's following Apple's normal way of operating is just about marginal improvements and slow and steady going through, I assume. The 7's going to be, although we haven't been able to get our hands on one, I assume the 7's going to be very much like that as well. So, yeah. Right. I think we're just going to cover what's coming up in the show, Jay, aren't we? So what's actually coming up?
So we're going to interview John from Splat, who's nicely joined us today. Thank you, John. And then we're going to go to our unboxing section.
Right.
So Emily, our social media guru, is going to be coming down with the...
Okay. And everything's going to be on our Twitter feed, so people can actually see via Periscope what's
going
on.
So if you go onto the @TechTalkShowUK, you'll be able to link to our Periscope and watch us live.
Yeah, okay.
And then once we've done that, we've got our executive producer Sue Nelson. She's interviewing Zoe Cairns, who is a social media guru, and she's actually gone into the UN and spoken about social media there, so she's very influential.
Yep.
And then to finish the show, we have Andrew Bennison from Prospect Games. He's going to be calling in on a telephone interview for us as well.
Yeah, and that's on with his new game, I think, called Unbox.
Yeah. I mean, what are the chances of that?
Yeah. So we always think we plan this, don't you?
Almost, yeah.
So
firstly, John, could you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to start Splat?
Well, I was a broker in the city, in the financial markets, for 25 years, and I was getting more and more interested in programming. And as a sideline, I was very interested in photography. So I was always out walking around in London. And about 14 years ago, I had an idea to put photographers and the buyers of commercial wall art together in a platform. And I went hurried back to my bedroom and created a little website. And before you knew it, we were selling photographs online. Opened it up to other photographers to join. And we have... in the region of 6,000 photographers now uploading photographs every hour of the day. And we have around 10,000 clients that are happily purchased unique wall art from these photographers. So that's what started the journey. And the team that put that company together, obviously, have got an awful lot of experience in the commercial market. And it made sense to me to make that team available to other people to leverage off of this experience that we've gained. So I created Splat, really as a company to help other people start on in a similar way in that kind of journey.
And an online presence is obviously really, really important for companies. And what advice would you give me as someone that was developing an idea or developing a business? What golden rules do you sort of tend to stick to for that?
When you're in startup phase, it's very important to keep your costs down.
Right.
If you can get a website up quite quickly and efficiently yourself using systems like Wix that help you self-build, potentially using CMSs like WordPress as well if you're a little bit more technical.
Yep.
And get it up and running yourself. Start running with it. Have the idea and go.
Yeah.
Look at reviewing it once you're starting to make some money.
Okay. Yep. And are there any sort of mistakes that people make at the start that are common in terms of a web presence or functionality?
They very often talk about the product,
right?
And they don't talk about solving the person's problem.
Yeah.
If you go over it at that angle, you'll find people are looking for a solution to their problem, not looking for the product you potentially have. So think about your marketing like that.
And I know we're going to talk a little bit about your software development arm a little bit later on, but what advice about this optimizing your presence? And because like most people now, whether it's Google or other search engines, I just bang in a question and say, how do I do this? Or what do I do this? And how do new companies try and get themselves in front of those?
Well, I've got an acronym for it. So a web presence is all an act.
Yeah.
A for architecture. So how well the website's built. If your systems are fast, and I mean really fast, you will have a competitive edge over your competitors and you will get higher in Google. Simple. Google really look at that. It's really important. C is for content. The content's got to be on point. It's got to be really about what you do and relevant. And lastly, trust. T for trust. You've got to be worthy. You've got to have loads of backlinks from worthy links as well. So find people in your industry. Try and get a link from them. Blog. Blogging's great for backlinks. Again, if you can get a link from educational site, that would be great.
Yeah. So,
building trust is the other part of it.
So that's credibility of the company or the idea is really, really crucial.
Yeah, and Google looks at how many links you get. People try and say, oh, it's not about link building. It is still one of the major algorithms that Google uses is how many links you have.
Really?
Obviously, social media is an important part of that. You need to have good social media links to your site as well.
Okay.
So you deal with SEO packages. Could you tell us more about them and kind of what they are?
Well, we start right at the beginning of that proposition you have to a new customer. What are you selling? So we take it right back to the basics. We look at your on-page words. We do on-page SEO. We advise on that to begin with. And then once that's up and running, we then start to build backlinks and write content for you. And that takes a long time. It can take a year.
Right.
But that's crucial, isn't it?
It is crucial to the trust element of your site.
So that's content specific, content wording, structure, so that when it is searched and when it is interrogated, it gives the appropriate...
Yeah. And the other thing is if you spend all that time and money on getting the traffic, if your conversion rate's low, you're just burning money because you've spent this money on SEO.
Yep.
But if your site doesn't perform and convert people, you'd be better off standing outside your front door burning £50 notes, to be honest. Yep. So you've really got to make sure the message is really on point and you look trustworthy as well.
Yeah. Okay, so measuring that conversion is obviously crucial to the success, i.e. how things are going. How would you suggest to people that they actually go around and measure conversion? Obviously, if it's a purchase website or there's a sale, then that's great because you can see the clicks through and you can see where people end up. But what about if it's not a direct sale website? How would you advise me to look
we use
it up?
Some quite clever tools that we plug in to the website, JavaScript, which actually shows hot points on your site where people are actually clicking around and looking. So straight away, you get a gauge whether people are actually finding what you're writing is interesting, finding the right information quickly. People have got no time today. 30 seconds is about the time you've got to make sure someone's interested in what you're trying to get out there.
For me, I'm the same. I have, you know, I can't sit there and just do something for hours. It has to be extremely quick. So you also deal with other packages such as Web Design Premium. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, actually, that product's closed off now. We're actually going to stop doing that. We've broken them down into an Express, a Plus, and something called Ultra, which is replacing the premium product we used to do. The way we used to do project, a large upfront cost. And the problem with that is that people can't. They know they should have it.
Yeah.
But they can't afford it.
Right.
I suddenly realised, well, if we could help some businesses out by doing monthly, so we spread the cost of your web build and design over 2 years. It's a two-year contract, just like buying a mobile phone. At the end of the 2 years, you get the option to renew, and we will update your site or it flicks back to a hosting-only package. So it's helping people get the site they really do need and deserve to convert more people.
And is your advice to people to constantly evolve their web presence? Is that, you know, some of what you do in terms of optimizing the success? Do you advise that we continue update new pages, new functionality? Is that the sort of thing?
Yeah, as long as it's not at the as long as you keep the site functional and the navigation clean, because if you find people get lost, if they're clicking around too much, they might not get to the right form, they might not contact you, and they might just get bored. So it's you have to have the right amount of content, not too much of it.
Right, and the key here is about what do your clients, customers, people that are visiting your site, what do they want, and actually giving them that.
And hitting it right at the top of the page, get a really clear heading.
Yeah.
You know.
So it's not about the architecture, it's about content first and then the architecture comes afterwards?
Yeah, if you're in a very competitive market space and your competitor's site is on, say, for instance, our bespoke solution, we will beat them in search because our sites are incredibly fast.
Yeah. Obviously, the second arm of your business is around software. So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing there.
Well, what we do, we solve complex logistical problems for businesses. So if you have, say, a minimum of 100 people working for you, you're working on 40, 50 different projects at one time, and your sales team are out trying to sell the product, and you're growing, it's making sure that the information is taken from, say, manufacturing floor through to operations out to the sales force, so they can see straight away, I can't actually give a promise on a date to a customer right now because I don't know when it's going to be delivered. But with our systems, they can actually log in and see straight away, that they can say, oh, well, in 2 weeks there's going to be availability, so I can actually get you, get your product out there to you within 2 weeks. And that's really what we do, is solve those problems and take it from cost-saving, increasing productivity all the way through to a unique selling proposition for them to their customer. That's really what these software does. Yeah.
So is each solution bespoke? Or
totally bespoke.
So, and that's through your company that's supplying that. Obviously, logistical management. I assume it's a workflow come logistics type.
Yeah, it manages workflow.
Yep.
Scheduling of the workflow. It will manage messaging out to clients, keep clients up to date with it. It's a complete solution that will systemize your business. Yeah.
And how have you found, obviously, developing software can be costly, time-consuming, but also it's about getting the right staff or the right subcontractors. How difficult has that been for you?
It's a case of elimination, really. If someone's not good enough at that particular role, then you have to move them into a different responsibility within your company because, you don't want somebody that's particularly creative in a role where they're dealing with numbers.
Yeah,
and vice versa. So it's finding the right fit for the right role.
Yeah, I mean, I've got some experience of workflow production and software development. The key thing was always, when I was involved, was actually understanding the business and what the business requirements are first.
Yeah.
And then actually go to the software second.
Yeah,
is that still?
There's a lot of time spent in a boardroom with pieces of A4 paper, really taking it old school. Right back to basics. What happens when this button's clicked? Who gets the notification? What kind of signal do you want in your company that this has got to be moved on? Who needs to be told about it? So it's really automating those systems and processes.
Yeah. So what tips would you give to people who are confused about SEO and web design? Is there anything
particular? There are some great courses you can go to that are run by colleges and things like that online. The thing where you can do quite a lot yourself. The on-page SEO, if you've got a CMS package, like a content management system, like WordPress, you can log in and do a lot of these things yourself.
Yeah.
If you can pick up something like SEO for Dummies.
SEO.
I don't know if that exists.
Somewhere on Amazon.
Yeah. I don't mean to sort of devalue what we do, but for the beginner, when you've got no budget, you've got to do it yourself.
Yeah.
There are over 250 different factors that change your position and rank on Google.
And you mentioned about kind of when you're starting up and you have no money and it's all quite tight. Did you have experienced those problems yourself when you began?
I had to teach myself. The reason why Photo for Me does so well is because organically it is very highly ranked. If you search for canvas prints of Dymchurch, we will be top of search.
Yeah.
And that's because of the way I've built the site and spent an awful lot of time researching the subject.
Yeah.
The really key thing is you mustn't upset Google. So make sure it's ethical. Make sure you are achieving links without buying them. Be really wary of companies in India where they're saying to you, oh, you can buy 100 backlinks for 100 quid. Mm. Well, at the moment, anything's too cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a question. Yeah.
Yeah. An iPhone 7 could never be too cheap. But no, it's really good. John, I know you're going to stay with us, so thank you so much. And perhaps just one last. So if I'm developing a product or developing a website, where do I go to get some information about that?
Oh, you come to me.
Yeah. So just give us your contact details.
Yeah, we're www.splatwebworks.co.uk.
Brilliant. Great to speak to you.
Thank you.
We're going to actually go to a pre-record now. So we've got a really good session from Zoe Cairns, who kindly talked to us a little bit earlier on around Periscope and how that works and integrates with Twitter. So Sue Nelson is in conversation with Zoe.
Hi, and I'm with Zoe Cairns of ZZ Social Media. And Zoe is very famous around Kent and in the southeast because she's considered a social media guru. She's even spoken at the United Nations about social media, and she just knows everything. She's my go-to person if I want to know what I should be doing in terms of social media. And the thing I've been listening to recently, Zoe, is all about Periscope. Should I be in Periscope? Shouldn't I? What the hell is it? So what do you think? Just tell us what Periscope is to start with.
Okay, Periscope is, in a nutshell, you having your own live TV channel through Twitter. So it's where people can go on and have live shows on what they're doing right now, normally behind the scenes. They might do Q&A sessions, and you can access it through your Twitter accounts. So when you go to actually take a picture on Twitter, it'll bring up a little camera icon, and it'll bring up the little Periscope icon next to it. When you click on it, you can actually start to go live on your Twitter account, and your followers start to see that you're live, and they can actually tune in. So they click on the link, it opens up the window, shows you live, and they can start asking you questions. So it becomes a live Q&A, a two-way conversation where people can ask questions, they can engage, they can say if they're loving it or liking it, with different love hearts and icons. And it's a great way to engage with your audience rather than you just broadcasting all the time.
So it's an interactive, it's almost like having one of those television programmes where you've got an audience sitting in there and they're shouting things backwards and forwards or asking questions, as opposed to you just pumping out content and not knowing what's happening to it. Is that a good synopsis?
Yeah, that's definitely a good synopsis. It's a great way to really bring your Twitter account and your community to life and really start getting an idea, especially if you're doing research. It's great to get on there and start, you know, even demonstrating a new product idea and getting feedback from your audience to their needs and requirements for it. It's that really great interaction.
So if you've got a new product or a new service, it's a really good way to sort of test, and yet another way to sort of test your stuff. Yeah. Do you use Periscope yourself? What do you use it for?
I'm a fan of Periscope. I don't use it as much as Facebook Live, which is exactly the same in Facebook. I prefer Facebook Live because that's where a lot of my audience are, whereas Twitter's where I engage more with journalists. However, my clients use Periscope. They use it very successfully, especially for product launches. So they might use it in a way that when they're going to launch a product, they say our product is launching later. We're going to give you a demo of it, and they give an online screen demo show around the product. It's just fantastic for that sort of product launch or behind the scenes of creating that product or service.
But presumably, though, because it's live, so you've either got Twitter or Facebook Live, it's got to be interesting. It's got to grab the attention of the audience. So in that respect, it's like any radio or television program. You know, it can't be too dry or too salesy. It's got to be interesting, hasn't it?
It's got to be really engaging. I always recommend to have a really catchy title for your live video. So if people are scrolling through their timelines, your title really catches them and they want to click to open up what the live chat's all about. But when they're in the live chat, if it is dry, you know, and it's really boring, they're not going to stay engaged. And some people just go on Periscope and they just talk, broadcast out. But when you start to engage and say, hi, so-and-so, who's just come in the chat, and how are you, and what do you think of this? And when you start to engage with the people coming in the chat and answer people's comments and questions, it's then that the audience get engaged, they feel important, they want to be involved. And that's the most successful Periscope shows and Facebook Live shows, that you get the maximum reach from it.
And if I was a new business and I'm thinking, oh, well, actually, Periscope Live, oh, that sounds interesting, and Facebook Live is good, how on earth do I set that up, and how do I go about it?
Okay, so Periscope Live, you download the Periscope app to your phone and you can log in with Twitter. So you do that first. Once it's on your phone and you've logged in with your Twitter account, you then go back onto Twitter, and as if you were taking a photo, you will then see, once you've clicked on the photo icon, you'll see the Periscope icon, and that's when you can start using Periscope.
Simple as that. And what about Facebook Live? I know when we do stuff here, Facebook Live seems to have the edge on Periscope. We get far more interaction, but I don't know whether that's just because that's where our target audience is.
Yeah, Facebook Live, again, is a great medium, great tool, and it's because the Facebook algorithm is absolutely loving live video at the moment. I get so much more response from Facebook Live because what happens is Facebook Live videos stay more in the timeline if it gets more engagement, whereas a Periscope video will work further down the timeline throughout the day, and that's why it's getting more reach.
And with Facebook Live, for example, you know, you could do, I don't know, a product launch, or you could talk about some new development that you've done. It could be anything. But if you're going to make it successful, presumably you've got to do a lot of social media beforehand to tee it up and get people interested. Don't just broadcast it and expect everybody to be there.
You need to plan it. It's like an event. You need to tell people that you're going to be live at a certain date. You know, put some tweets together, put some images together. Make sure you get it out there and you get out there as much as possible. And find influencers that can share it for you that might already be talking to your audience. Get as much exposure as you can. Really build it up. And also have a team behind you that when you do go live, they're sharing it as well in relevant groups. They're retweeting it. They're talking about it as well to direct people to it. So really try and get out there as much as you can.
So plan it beforehand, make sure that the event's really engaging and interesting, make sure you're talking backwards and forwards to people, and afterwards, presumably, get yourself some publicity around it and invite comments as well, so that you've got a bit of longevity afterwards as well as planning it before.
Yeah, because if it's not actually time sensitive and it's actually really great content that can be used over and over again, you might decide to save it to your camera roll, which means you save the video and you can upload it to your website and direct people back to your website, which again encourages more leads and inquiries, potentially sales as well. So continue to use it and continue to drive people to that really great content that you're creating.
And with your company, ZC Media, if somebody said, you know, I'd really like to get into this and social media is passing me by a little bit, clearly I need to do things like Facebook Live, maybe more on Twitter. How can they get in touch with you? How can they use your company?
They can get in touch with us by looking at zcsocialmedia.com. We can help you put a strategy together as how you would use Facebook Live or Periscope, because it's important that you know what you want to achieve. There's no point going on there not having a call to action at the end. But yeah, look at ZC Social Media. I'm Zoe Cairns. You'll find me online and I'll be more than happy to help you.
Well, you've always helped me in the past, especially when I've had some really stupid questions like, Zoe, I don't actually know what this new technology is. But overall, you know, if you've got something that your audience are on Facebook, or you've got journalists who are on Twitter, you really should investigate whether you should be on Periscope or Facebook Live.
Yeah, I would definitely have a look into it, research it, talk to us, and definitely use the new technologies and strategies in order to get your business where you want it to be.
And look at people who you think are doing it really successfully as well. So, you know, really research who you think is good and try and replicate that. Zoe Cairns, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Sue.
Well, welcome back. And I think some really good advice there, sort of followed on from what we were talking about earlier with Splat and John there. So we're now joined on the line by Andrew. Hi, Andrew. Can you hear us?
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, great. Welcome to the show, and hope everything's good with you. Thanks for spending the time to talk to us. Now, we must talk about your new game. I know it was launched just 2 days ago. Is that right?
Yeah, we launched at 2 p.m. on Monday on Steam.
Yeah, I saw that, and some of the promo video looked fantastic. A real 90s platform game.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's basically the long and short of it. We grew up playing games in the 90s, especially the likes of like Mario and Banjo-Kazooie, like fun, colorful games that are just, you know, built for fun. And we figured, okay, well, if we're going to make a game of our own, it'd be really cool to make something like that.
So, Andrew, you began your career by enrolling in a computer video games course at the University of Salford. Have you always been passionate about gaming? You know, how did you get into it? What's been your kind of drive?
Yeah, I think it really started when my parents got me a Manchester United Game Boy at age 4. and I started off playing Asteroids and Missile Command, and it kind of went from there. I've always been really into gaming. Probably a bit too much at some points, played a bit too many games. But I kind of grew up wanting to get into games journalism, and I did a media course at college where I ended up making a film in a game. And that got me really interested in the sort of mechanics of behind the scenes, how games work. And when I discovered there was a games course, I figured, okay, I do like journalism, but I've also really enjoyed kind of making stuff in games. Wouldn't it be great to make games? And I just sort of, I took the plunge with relatively little skills, and that's where I met people on the course who kind of really helped me come into my own and start learning how to make games.
Kind of, did you develop quite a good network of games developers there?
The people who started the company that we're at now, that's where I met them.
Oh, brilliant. So quick question I have to ask, was your original Game Boy one of those huge block grey ones.
A classic.
They are the
red
classic.
Though, Manchester United is a nice red one.
We were talking, obviously, with the PS4 Pro launch this week, we were talking about that earlier, Andrew, and about how games consoles have changed during the... I mean, I was brought up with the Sega Mega Drive, which I loved Sonic. So that's why... when I saw Unbox, I thought, yeah, this is a real classic platform game. Yeah, where did you, where did you start your gaming developing? What did you design first, or what sort of journey have you gone on over the years?
Well, during university, there was a lot of concepting and prototyping. It kind of ended with a big third year project where we actually had to build a proper game, start to finish, as a sort of a vertical slice. And we made a point-and-click adventure game. So again, quite an old-school concept, and we tried to bring it into the modern era. Once I left uni, we all kind of went our separate ways for a bit. I got into doing modding, so I was taking games that already exist and tweaking them,
right.
Doing some freelance work in the industry.
Yep.
And then with some of the founders, we kind of felt like it would be really cool to go back to what we were doing in university, which was having fun and making games, and it would be great to build a company around that. So... we started making prototypes in the evening, just after work when we could. And eventually that led to a few concepts that we thought were good enough to justify putting some money in and quitting our jobs and starting a company up. So we did just that.
And that's how Prospect Games came about?
That's exactly how it came about. I mean, we were essentially a modding team first, just doing stuff in other games, but it was doing that and seeing people liking what we were making that kind of made us think, well, we could make money from this if it was our own IP, so let's try it out.
So how, you know, when you are developing an idea for a game, how do you go about testing that in terms of consumers or gamers? How do you go about establishing whether that idea is actually going to go forward?
The only way to do it is really get it out there, and there's a number of ways you can. With Unbox, it really came about because very early on we put demos out of the game and videos and got people playing it. And there was a lot of local community events involving gamers and games developers who we gave it to and just said, you know, what's your honest opinion of this? And going to events, showing it online, playing it endlessly ourselves, gave us all the feedback we needed to ascertain, well, is this even worth continuing to make? So with Unbox in particular, we were very stringent on if people aren't liking this in week one, week two, week three, and liking it more and more as we try to improve it, we've got to ditch it. And it was that very, very iterative, sort of almost weekly assessment of how the game's going that has brought us to where we are today.
And I mean, are you developing other games at the same time, or are you just, do you tend to focus just on the one gamer or the one concept at any one time?
We certainly come up with ideas almost on a daily basis. It's hard to stop the team going off on a tangent and going, oh, we should make this, you know, this massive game which has this and that. And it's very easy to do that. We've tried to focus very much on getting Unbox done to the best of our ability,
making it the best game possible. It does look really good, I have to say. It looks a great, you know, there's very different levels to it, different platforms. It looks great.
So aside from Unbox, what's your favourite game?
That's a tricky one, because I mean, I feel like I haven't played games in years now, because we've just been so glued to our PCs.
Them.
Yeah, building them. I think probably historically Natural Selection 2, which is a bit of a niche first-person shooter mixed with a kind of RTS commander mode, and I really liked playing in that, because it was fun just telling people where to go and what aliens to shoot, so I got a kick out of that.
And I know we're going to talk about marketing around games in a little while, but just to focus. So with Unbox, you've got a four-player mode, is that right?
Yes, local local multiplayer.
So it's a local multiplayer. There's no online presence or online gaming system there, is there?
No, we really wanted to make an experience like we had when we were kids.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side, it's also, you know, doing online is something that's really popular right now again amongst the big companies. Trying to compete with those guys is you're facing an uphill battle.
Yeah,
and there's also just the financial constraints of, you know, if you want to have an online game, you've got to have servers, you've got to have people on board 24/7 maintaining things. The costs really stack up quick. So we figured, well, let the big guys make online games. We'll focus on an area of gaming that's not had a lot of love recently, but people clearly want.
I think you've hit a niche, actually. I think that is about just sitting down with mates and actually playing a game. A bit of, you know, you've got the sort more senior gamers like myself who are slightly older that remember some of the older games. And actually there's that, it is nice to play games together. And, you know, when I looked at it, it very much took me back to sort of the 90s type games that were available then, which is great. So in terms of promoting, I know you're based on Steam, and was it launched on Steam? Is that where you went first?
Yes. Yeah, so Steam is like a digital storefront. It's the primary one people use on PC, so we figured this is the best place to start.
And how have you gone about actually taking forward your marketing approach? What sort of things are you doing?
Well, we've tried to be quite reactive. So running up to it, we've been doing a lot of outreach to various communities on different websites, obviously really pushing on the social media side of things, because that's a great way to get your message out to a lot of people. Trying to forge connections with journalists and other influencers like YouTubers and Twitch streamers who will essentially play your game while talking about it. And that acts as one of the most effective kind of marketing strategies, is just get people to play it and get people watching those people playing it.
Yeah,
and these are, you know, there are YouTubers, you know, PewDiePie is a word that's batted around a lot. Everyone's heard of him. He's got millions of followers. So if you can get your game in front of somebody like that, you suddenly have access to, you know, a country-sized audience.
Yeah.
So I guess the audience that you're targeting, is it kind of young people? Is it a mixture of everyone? Like, who are you specifically trying to target with the game?
Sure, it's a bit of a mix. Definitely at the sort of core market is basically people like us, sort of 25 to 35-year-olds who grew up playing these games. But we found very early on, and originally Unbox was much harder. It was built for like a hardcore gaming market with that sort of age bracket in mind. But when we took it to events, we found kids were loving the game because they've not really played anything like this. And especially local multiplayer is so often not seen, that they're used to playing online with their friends only. So we tried to be as reactive as possible. We realized, okay, we could tap into a much larger market of sort of families with young children in the sort of 7 to 12 category, who really, I mean, at events, families would come up and just leave their kids at our store. The parents would go off and find something like Call of Duty and come back 3 hours later knowing that their kids are still going to be playing. So the target market really changed over the course of development, and that influenced the design of the game itself.
And I suppose the 25 to 35-year-old market, they kind of have that nostalgia for 90s games. I mean, I was personally obsessed with Super Mario and kind of those sort of games. And I suppose that's quite a good market for you to target, especially as you launch the game.
Oh, absolutely. So just the buzzwords in marketing of 3D platformer or Banjo and Kazooie, Mario 64, these are things that immediately evoke an emotional reaction in a big chunk of our audience. And that makes it a bit easier to market to them, because we can say, hey, you know, we're influenced by these games, but we're also bringing a lot of new stuff to the table.
So I know it's available on PC, but are you looking to kind of create an app as well that you can, like Pokemon Go kind of thing, that's kind of very interactive as well?
Oh, I mean, we, again, as part of those conversations where we go off on tangents, we've come up with all sorts. I mean, we really would like to do a lot more with Unbox, and we're focusing on the Steam launch, and we're trying to be as sales-driven as possible. So based on how well we sell, with who we sell, and what those people are telling us, most importantly, on Twitter, on our personal forums, that's going to be everything we need to know to determine what we're going to do next. And, you know, high on the list is people asking, oh, it'd be great if this was online, or oh, it'd be great if it's on Xbox. And we just have to be very careful not to overpromise things, which is, it's very easy to do when people are saying, oh, we'd love for you to do this. You just kind of want to go, yeah, we want to do it as well. But everything costs money.
And also, it's about a commercial decision, isn't it? At the end of the day, you know, you see lots of game developers perhaps haven't got that commercial background, and they really need support. And I know our other guest, John, has been involved in helping businesses improve their presence and get their message out. It is really important, isn't it, about matching your money to where you can have the greatest impact.
Yeah, you've just got to do some marketing basic research and marketing together. It sounds like you're doing all the right things to me. I mean, if you can get a really famous YouTuber that's a game player, I mean, that's a really good idea.
Yeah.
Has that been successful for you?
Thus far, I mean, I think we're at pretty much day 3 as of in the next hour or so.
Yeah.
It's been pretty good so far, considering that we're an independent outlet. We're working with a PR team to assist us as well, and we've had a lot of developers and other people who have been through this process help us. We've had YouTubers with 1 million subscribers playing the game, and this is very, very early days. With something like this, it's kind of like a process of osmosis, where if you can only reach channels with, say, 50,000 followers, get enough of those to play it, and next week you might get 60,000 followers and 70,000. So there's no real one way of doing things, and again, like with all of it, we have to be really reactive, and if one channel is really pushing the game hard, we want to try work with them and help them and maybe even produce content bespoke to their channel to assist in making content for them.
Yeah, no, and I say the stuff I've seen looks great, I have to say. So if I were a young game developer and you know, new to the market, and I'm trying to get my idea out there, what were the golden rules you've learned over the last year or two that you would perhaps give in terms of advice?
There's many things I could tell a young budding developer, but I think everything spans off of one thing, and that's scope. Scope affects everything. It affects, if you're going to make a massive game, it's going to cost a massive amount of money. If you have a massive game, it needs a lot of marketing. So everything falls off of scope, and I've been advising a lot of devs recently because I've been seeing Unboxer go, wow, how did you do it? I went, you know, with a really impressive team and a lot of drive, but it also took a lot out of us. And I, looking back, think we maybe should have done something a bit smaller to begin with. And that's what I've been telling most developers is, instead of making the game of your dreams or even just a game that you really want to do, try make something really small that you can at least that has a beginning, middle, and end that you can get to market, maybe generate an audience, and just assess and from that and learn lessons and apply that to your next project. Because we made a small app before this, and the quantum leap between what that was and what Unbox is was gigantic.
Yeah.
And I think maybe taking those steps one at a time rather than leaping is probably a better idea. But, you know, then games like Minecraft come along and make 2 billion. So
yeah, I mean, the market is absolutely colossal. And I think, you know, I think where you're headed in terms of focusing your current game is a really niche, and well, not just niche and small, but actually I don't see many other people doing that, so I think it's great. Have you got plans to scale up Unbox? Is it, you know, are you looking at other areas, or are you going to move on to something new?
We would love to scale up Unbox. We'd love to make more content for it, and we'd really like to get it onto more platforms like Xbox, PlayStation, and other console devices. It's, again, it comes back to sales. If we make the money to be able to do it, we will. If we don't, then it's lessons learned, and we can apply that to maybe another product.
Yeah, and where, you know, where can we go? Obviously, we've got lots of media being created around Unbox, but where can we go to get information about your company? Where do we go?
Best two websites is unboxgame.com or prospectgames.co.uk if you want to learn more about our company. And on both of those sites, you can get links to our Steam page where you can check out Unbox, watch the trailers, and if you feel like it, give it a purchase.
Yeah,
I think the gaming industry is really interesting at the moment, especially with kind of iPhones and Samsung and all of that sort of stuff. Because, you know, I remember, I think it was last year, they had Flappy Bird, which was a game you could download. And it was, you know, the interface was rubbish. And yet it was the most popular game for months and months and months, so much so that the developer took it down. And there's kind of lots of those games that you don't, I don't know, it seems to me that you don't have to invest loads of money in creating an amazing platform for it to be popular necessarily, especially if you're kind of delving into the nostalgia of people kind of my age, especially, who, you know, Flappy Bird was a rubbish interface, but it reminded them of a kind of a rubbish Super Mario interface that they once used, which I think is quite interesting how the market's going.
Yeah, and there's a huge element of luck to all this, that, you know, for every Flappy Bird, there's 1,000 other games that were very similar to it before it that, for whatever reason, didn't pick up. And it's, that's why I think taking those small steps makes more sense, because if you've got all your eggs in one basket and you end up falling flat on your face, well, you've just lost everything. Whereas doing lots of iterative games, much like King did back in the day, the creators of Candy Crush, Candy Crush was one of hundreds of games that they'd made, and that's the one that happened to pick up. Now, had they invested all their money into just one of those IPs from before and not done and not spread their assets far and wide, well, then they'd have never had Candy Crush and they'd have never made it big. So I think taking small steps and trying to create a bit of luck for yourself is probably the most sensible thing you can do.
Definitely.
And I should follow my own advice.
Definitely. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Andrew.
It's been really good to speak to you, Andrew. And just one more time, give us the link to your website and where people can go to have a look at.
Sure. Thank you guys for having me on. Best place to get all the Unbox information is unboxgame.com.
Brilliant. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew. Great to speak to you,
and good luck with the launch. I think it's going to be a fantastic game. In fact, I'm going to buy it today. So cheers,
hey.
Andrew. Thanks, mate.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So we are now going to go to our regular feature, Jay,
yep.
Which is...
unboxing, and Emily, our social media guru, has just come down to join us.
Great.
So every week we have our unboxing segment on the show. For listeners who don't know, unboxing is where you get to hear real live first impressions on products that our Tech Talk researchers have sourced for us from some of our very special guests. We don't know what's in the box until our guests open it, and they can make a decision of either back in the box or that rocks. So please watch us on Periscope by clicking on the Tech Talk Show UK Twitter feed, and we'll answer any questions that you might have. And Emily will be reading out some comments as we go as well.
Yep. So we're on Twitter as we speak, but we've got no Periscope, I understand. But anyway, we will be putting this up later, the video. So, John, over to you. What is in the box?
It's not even my birthday.
No, it's not. But
Christmas come early.
Right. Wow. VR ShineCon.
ShineCon. So it looks like it's a virtual reality headset. From here.
Yeah. Okay, quite good packaging. We've got a large black box VR ShineCon, which looks pretty good. And it's a slider type system.
What are your kind of initial impressions of the box and the marketing on the box, John?
It's quite tight. I'm not sure about the fact that this is all sort of a bit sloppy the way they've done that, but the actual product itself looks good.
Yeah, so for our listeners who obviously can't see the box, it's kind of got a big image of the headset on the front, and then all of the box is black, and then the actual logo is kind of, the VR bit is in green and the rest is in white. So it looks quite, it's like a simple packaging that it's got going on there.
Yeah, it just says VR ShineCon, virtual reality glasses. Shall we?
Yeah, plug into it.
Okay. I know we're going to need my phone in a minute, so I've got that already with something, so which is great.
Okay, so loosely packaged on the inside, so nothing protecting it. Which would be a bit of a worry if it was coming...
Oh, there was. There was a little bit. It was removed for ease.
I understand. It looks like it's got a VR reality user manual there.
Yeah.
And is that...
It's got left and right. Which is always good.
Okay, full instructions on what to do. They look quite clear, actually. They're relatively straightforward.
Yeah, pretty good. Right, product itself...
How heavy is it?
It's quite light, actually.
Is it?
I'm surprised at how light, bearing in mind how big and black it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've got some adjustment on the outside.
Yeah.
I'll help you with opening that in a sec, actually. If Jay passes it round, I'll actually get...
And there's also quite comfortable-looking head strap that I guess you can put around your head.
Fully adjustable.
Yeah.
I'm just reaching over and grabbed the glasses. Would they be called glasses? Yeah, virtual
reality. Yeah, 3D glasses.
So what you have to do is press down on the top. I am trying as we speak, and that's not easy. I need someone
it's
with
quite magnetic.
Fingernails.
Mm. Oh, there we go.
There we go.
And you place your iPhone or other device into the holder. And what I've done actually is downloaded a VR roller coaster free app.
That's exciting.
Which is branded, it's a different company, but it's linked in with the VR app that you can download free,
right.
Which I've done. So you place that in, and oh, no, hold on. I've got something come up on that. Will it let me play it, or have I got to buy it?
Oh no, technical problems.
Jay, what's gone wrong? So I'm holding this up to the camera. There's the actual video.
So is it split the screen in half though? Is that
yeah,
so you can see both of them? Yeah.
So okay. Put it in there. I'm I'm not sure if I've got it round the wrong way, or let's try it the other way. Do you know, these things always work in the office earlier. And then...
So I think it's important to point out as well, there's no side effects for your eyesight at all with this product, which is good, because I thought when you have a screen so close to your eyes, it surely must have something that could affect your eyes.
So that's not actually playing, though, is it?
It's not playing, but I think if we give it to John, he can just have a look and see if he can see what he can see, and what he thinks about the actual fit of it as well. John's just entered another world.
So John's got the glasses on. He cannot see anything other than what's on the screen in front of his eyes.
Quite odd.
Yeah.
So it's not actually playing, John? No.
No, it is. Yeah, I'm on a little
train. Are you immersed?
Well, it's actually a roller coaster, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm on a roller coaster, and I'm going up a hill. It really is quite immersive.
Actually. And what about if you look up? So what happens if you look up?
Oh wow.
So you, what can you see?
I'm scared of heights.
No, don't.
The last thing we want is
don't look down. So I'm clearly going to get very scared in a minute. So.
And is it hurting your neck at all, or is it not too bad?
You could definitely wear it for quite a while, I think. You know,
yeah, it's nice and light.
Oh, hold on. tell us what's happening.
I'm going downhill, and it's if I face that way.
Yeah, what happens if you look behind you?
If you look behind, I can see the roller coaster tracks going behind me. It's really, really good, actually.
Yeah, obviously, John's the reason his voice is coming and going is because he's moving his head around.
Sorry.
You carry on, because it's important that you see the whole effect. So yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually quite impressed. I was a bit cynical, particularly of VR. I still haven't bought into the idea.
No. And I think VR is going to be huge, personally. I think, you know, it's all you need is split-screen technology, and then that's it. Pop them off. I might have a look. Jay, you going to have a look?
Yeah, I'll have a look.
Is it still running? So, yeah.
Yeah, very good. I think if there's some applications for that in the gaming industry.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean...
I'm also terrified of heights as well, just to point out.
Right, so what's going on the screen now?
Well, I'm just kind of going over a mountain.
Right.
It's quite terrifying, but very immersive, and you can see absolutely everything, every detail, which is really cool. The sky is so blue as well. It's fantastic. But yeah, it looks great. It's also really useful to point out that this is for iPhone 6 or 6S. So this particular model of the VR headset. So if you have an iPhone like me, which is an iPhone 5, you can't actually use it.
You can, because mine's a 5 and it's actually in there, Jay.
Oh, okay. Sorry, don't listen to me.
That might be to get the most from it, I assume.
The most immersive experience.
Yeah.
Brill.
So obviously we'll talk a little bit more about VR in a minute, because I think that's really important. I'm now going to have a quick look.
Yes.
So over to you. I'll let you carry on talking.
Yeah. So while Steve's putting on the headset, just a few other things to point out about it. It's also, the screen is big enough for prescription glasses as well. So you can put your glasses back on, Steve, if you want.
Thank you.
It's also, can you fit a Samsung phone, HTC as well, as long as they're 6 inches. As I mentioned earlier, no side effects for your eyesight, and the adjustment of focal length can be up to 20 millimeters. So it's perfect for videos, movies, and games as well. So it seems really great, but the thing that I find absolutely really interesting about it is the cost. So, John, how much would you pay for this particular headset?
That's a tricky one, actually. I've got no basis to sort of value on it.
Have another look.
£100?
Bear in mind that there's no technology. Actual screen.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe £100. It feels like it's maybe £150,
yeah. So, the big news is that the actual price of the product is £62.99. However, we got it on Amazon 75% off at £15.89.
No way.
So, I think that's a pretty good deal that we got for that.
Yeah, agreed.
And what do you think? Do you think people in your office would use that?
If I could get more work out of them, yes.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you very much.
So,
So, so would you put it back in the box, or would you say that rocks and you'd keep it?
Oh, I think it rocks. I'll keep rocks? It,
yeah. Yep, especially for that price range.
Yeah.
Definitely. Jay, what about you?
Definitely. For £15, bargain.
I think that's fantastic, yeah. In fact, bargain. Yeah, I was really impressed with the quality of the actual video and how it looks through, though. Yep. I mean, VR is a huge area, and I know that computer and computing power is going to really move VR forward, and I don't know if you've any experience, John, of that at all.
No, not yet.
No, but what we were talking about in previous stories in previous shows is actually about by increasing computer power, VR can be used for a huge number of things. Mm. Obviously, a lot of it comes out of military and simulation. So what we're seeing is some of that technology now bleeding across into other areas. So for battleground simulation, or it could be emergency services simulation, VR is used to train staff because it can be so immersive in terms of what you're doing. And the other thing I've seen quite recently is where you've got a particularly hazardous job or repetitive job, then VR can be used as a way to actually operate robotic or other elements that then go forward.
And lots of brands as well are starting to use Oculus Rift and brands like that as well to kind of create a more immersive experience for their customers, which is really interesting as well.
I assume, John,
Yeah, there was a friend of mine that's been involved with the designing of oil rigs, and they were actually using VR software to actually get a feel for the building.
Yeah.
Because obviously you can't do that unless you've actually got a huge oil rig built.
Yeah, well, that seems because I used to work on some projects where were to do with new builds, and doing a fly through, a VR fly through, is really, really useful to actually assess the usability of the building, the flow of people through the building, and use of areas. And that's only come about with the VR technology that we have available. So, yeah, I think we'll see that grow and grow. And I suppose gaming is another area where it will drive development.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely.
I think so, definitely, yeah.
No, that's absolutely right. So, we're sort of coming to the end of the show.
Yep.
I know we always cover a few little bits. So what have you got, Jay? Have you got anything for us?
So I just read this morning, just before we go, that Switzerland has been voted the most innovative country in the world.
Right.
Which is interesting. Apparently the UK is second.
Yep.
But apparently Switzerland for the last 6 years as well has been ranked number one. And according to this report, it's a tiny European country that's managed to stay at the top because it consistently leads the world in per capita patent applications, novel use of cutting edge technology, and university programs that, quote, groom new talent. So well done, Switzerland.
I think that index is actually really surprising, because I suppose if we'd ask most people, perhaps you, John, you know, where would you go or say which country's got the most innovation?
I would have said Great Britain was right up
there, to be honest. Yeah, which is great. I mean, we are second, so. But I really wouldn't have gone to Switzerland, that's for sure. So
I mean, they do great chocolate, but great innovation as well.
Maybe it's innovation in chocolate.
Yeah, maybe, who knows?
anyway. So, what's coming up? Do we know what's coming up next week? Have we got any ideas of the show?
Well, we'll have some more amazing guests, some more amazing unboxing.
And we'll go for that. So in the meantime, how can people get hold of us, Jay?
So we'd love to hear from you. So if you want to get in touch via our Twitter handle, which is @TechTalkShowUK, or via our website, which is thetechtalkshow.co.uk. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love your feedback. If you want to talk about anything that we've had on the show today, then please get in touch.
Yeah, fantastic. And actually, the vote online for the iPhone 7 was 50% would pay $1,000.
Really?
50% wouldn't. So it's really straight down the
middle. Straight in the middle,
So
interesting.
But obviously, looking at the studio and the people in here, I don't think any of us would pay £1,000 for a mobile phone, would we?
No.
Thank you very much, John,
for joining us.
It's been fantastic, and it's great to talk through some of the work you're doing. And especially the two areas, and obviously the work of Splat is, and there's more information online for
Thank
people
you very
to
much.
Go to. So yeah, great. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you, Steve.
Good show, and
see you next week.
Yeah, look forward to it. Cheers.
wants to see you smiling.